to Minority Corner
with an Eke
and James,
the Wonder Twins of podcasting.
Learn, laugh, play.
It's like Blue's Clues,
only it's more black, queer,
and ladylike.
This week on Minority Corner, woo!
What you got? Where are you coming from? What do you got?
I just was looking at you for a few seconds. Well,
I was waiting.
I got a hot mess is what I got coming at you. And I've got so much.
Okay.
I got a special interview with a very special guest here.
Ooh, who is it?
Huge activist all up in. You might recognize his vest.
Oh my God.
We got DeRay McKesson here on the show today.
Wow.
So stick around. It's going to be an action-packed interview.
It's big.
What have you got, Mama?
I'm about to talk about abortion around the world, what's going on in Argentina, in Chile, and what you may or may not know about certain policies that are in other countries. Some may surprise you.
Whoa. I have an update to someone we talked about in episode 6, Michael Johnson, aka Tiger Mandingo. I have an update to what happened with him.
Yes.
And scandal is done, so we better send it off.
And sending it off with a kiss on a rose. How does that song go?
Kiss on a rose. Kiss from a rose. Do, do, do.
Yeah. I'm glad I'm not alone on that one.
I don't remember any of those words.
Kiss neither from do I. A rose. Thanks, do, do, do.
Batman.
Let's go to the show.
Welcome to... Oh, we already did that.
No, we're just here now. Oh. What is...
Oh, man. It's just,
I like this way of starting the show. It's like we just jump in a cold ice bath. Well, just we're here.
I just wanted to welcome everybody again. And speaking of ice cold burr baths, do you know what? Do you know what I like to do every morning?
What's that? Take an ice cold bird bath?
Well, no, but it's close.
Go to your neighbor's bird bath and stick your butt in it.
Yes, because nobody, my neighborhood in Harlem, you know, everybody loves the bird baths here.
They do. They just put them out on the stoop.
They just, that's exactly it. But no, I do this thing and it sucks, but it's amazing. At the last, at tail end of my shower, I'm usually listening to some R&B girl groups, you know, still in that zone.
Yes. Revisit that episode if you haven't.
Just a few weeks ago. And I will turn the water to cold for a minute. For 1 minute.
Oh, yeah, I've heard about this.
Okay, yeah, so you don't think I'm crazy.
No.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Once you start doing it, you're like, even those those mornings where I'm like, I don't want to do it. Because I want to be comfortable. I'm like, ugh. But when you do when you do the cold shower, it shocks your system. And gets rid of all of the pent up energy and anxiety and stress that your body has, and also is really good for your pores because it closes them up.
It closes. That's why I've heard of it, where people do it for the pores, it closes them up, and for your hair, it closes the cuticle. Ooh. So your hair is shinier when you rinse it in cold water.
I don't wet my hair in the shower, girl. Mm-mm.
You don't?
Mm-mm. Not unless I'm gonna wash it and condition it.
Ooh, you just like me.
Yeah, girl.
Actually, I have braids right now, so I'm just fancy free and letting it,
just
get
it wet.
Woo!
Get it wet.
Walking free in the rain. I don't care.
Oh, but also, too, when I was at my TM, my Transcendental Meditation Workshop, they described this, that when a zebra gets chased by a lion, and after it survives, it'll just sit there and just shake for minutes, because it gets the rest of stress and anxiety out. And we as humans
don't do that.
We carry our stress and anxiety with us for years on end. So on top of doing meditation, when I'm also doing the shower, I feel like I can literally, and I feel alive and woo afterwards. And I'm always, that was my spiel. That was my tangent.
That's a James tip for the day.
Yeah.
Shock your system. Get fucking ready for the day.
Yeah.
Do you like that? I just added an extreme level to
it. Because we're kids from the 90s. Everything was extreme.
Yeah.
So that's how we
roll. It's true. Extreme. Export.
We should do this is the Minority Corner. Extreme. Extreme Edition.
Extreme! Jugga, 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 jugga. Mountain Dew!
Wow! Did you ever hear that, doesn't Mountain Dew, isn't Mountain Dew bad for men's, like, semen?
That's a lie. Oh, okay. That's a big old lie.
We're also
like
myth-busting
one of those...
on this episode.
I mean, that's an easy myth-buster, though. What? Come on.
Yellow number five, I heard. I still stay away.
No, it's red number three. Or, that was the
or
problem.
Or was it Mambo number five? I can't remember.
A little bit of Jessica on my side. By the way, I bought that. No, I didn't. I used to listen to that song in high school all the time. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine gave me the best birthday present, high school present, I'll always remember. Thanks, which is terrible because I've gotten some really good presents.
That's the only one, the one I remember. She's like, have you given
I remember the other ones.
She don't remember at all. Someone like
I remember the other
like
ones. And I've gotten
made
some
you,
great
like, a
ones.
Scarf. And like embroider your name on it.
I've
you're like,
had,
don't remember it.
I've had scarves made for me. So, okay, but this one, I just remember it in its simplicity really meant the world to me. It was a CD of Lou Bega.
Sorry.
Mambo number five.
I'm done. I'm going home.
And a bag of Sour Patch
yes,
Kids.
Yes, that is like
quintessential.
Like,
you know me.
That is like quintessential, like as a teenager in the 90s, early aughts. That's a quintessential yeah. birthday present. Sour Patch.
It was.
I'm surprised you didn't also get Hot Cheetos. Like, that was the only thing that was missing.
I don't think Hot Cheetos existed then.
Okay. Those were, like, ever.
I don't know.
Mm, well.
How old am I?
Where am I? Ooh, she's lost it. I knew that dementia day would happen sooner or later.
Hey,
I
said, hey
I,
now.
I just didn't think it would happen.
You're an all-star.
Oh, we're going into it. Oh, and okay, I don't want to get into the details of it, but correct me yes. if I'm wrong. You have finished Scandal.
Yes, I have finished Scandal. I sent it off on its ice igloo ice cube to go into the horizon of the setting Arctic sun.
You know, we talked a lot about Scandal on this show, and I think we should
yes,
send
we did.
It off as well.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I want to, I think that people forget that how revolutionary this show was.
Yeah. I mean, Scandal is a testament to going out on top.
Yeah.
Which it did not do, but
it wasn't the worst.
It was
finale.
Radical.
It was very radical.
It was It was radical for black women starring.
Yes, there wasn't another black before Olivia Pope. Like now, you see them. They're not everywhere, but they're more of them.
They've multiplied to where we had a renaissance where black women leading a show came back in style.
Yeah,
because of Kerry Washington, because of crazy ass Olivia Pope.
Yeah,
because Scandal was
character.
So juicy.
Like you can say Olivia Pope and people. People, like it was so it's so pulpy of the water cooler
people
conversation
know.
People know like if I make I'm Olivia Pope in this, you know, they get it
right. Like Grey's Anatomy was amazing, but I feel like Shonda Rhimes really came on the map because of Scandal's success.
Agreed. Yeah. And through the success of Scandal, she was then able to have, for 3 years, she had her TGIT, thank God it's Thursday,
yes.
Powerhouse Night. And I remember when I was in Times Square, there was a banner and it had like the three women of this, you know,
TGIT.
And two of the women were black. And it's just like, this is the world that we're living in. And this was not the case 8 years ago. There was not this. And you wouldn't have had shows like Being Mary Jane or...
Stop laughing at my girl, Gabrielle Union.
You know what? I'm happy Gabby's...
We also need to see Breaking In. We need to do a Minority Corner review of Breaking In.
Oh, I am going to go support Mother's Day weekend. That is where I am going. They mess with the wrong...
You know.
I see.
You know.
I live in Harlem. Those banners are everywhere in our subway station. They know exactly the audience that they are gunning for. Mother's Day.
I mean, that's where we saw that Holly Berry poster, too.
Yeah, well, it's exactly where we did see it. Yeah, I bet Hallie wishes she could have done this one. I think Gabby's going to bring it. Gabby's going to bring it in this breaking...
She always brings it.
I love her. She's in the right
Speaking
movie.
Speaking of...
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you said this. I've been watching the NBA playoffs because I like basketball.
Yes, you do.
And I've been watching it with Andrew. We watched the Miami Heat play and Dwayne Wade was playing. And I was talking about how much I like Dwayne Wade and how he's a great player, even though I'm full Golden State Warriors fan, Steph Curry forever. But I was like, I appreciate Dwayne Wade. And then I started talking about how much I love Gabrielle Union and how I'm glad that they're together. And now Andrew has been taken to making fun of me that I want to be a part of their relationship and that I'm like
do you follow
emailing them.
Do you follow them on Instagram?
No,
Oh, you are missing out. I follow Gabby Union on Instagram, and it is the best thing. Gabrielle Union was the first, this is random, she was for whatever reason the first celebrity that I started following on Instagram.
What?
I know, it's random. I was
That's
like,
random as hell. And here you are giggling at being Mary Jane when you are a secret stan for Gabby Union.
Never seen, I've seen actually a 1 minute and 22 seconds of being Mary Jane.
Then why are you following? Because she's great.
She's great.
Because why not? I answered my own question.
Exactly. She was, I hadn't met her. It wasn't like, you know, I think Mean Now When was the second one that I followed because I had met her, you know.
Well, she's,
And I met her.
And she's great,
She's great, too. But yeah, Gabby Union. And I still don't, I think I maybe follow five celebrities and one of them, because I don't want them filling up my feed.
And they fill them up, too. It's like, I need to start
Gabby
weeding
Union,
someone out.
The Rock. And
what?
Britney Spears. Those are my celebrities.
That is an eclectic
and
grab
Ming
bag. Not
when. Yeah, I know.
It's diverse.
They come from
very diverse.
Different walks of the entertainment industry. And
that right there is James. If anybody were to look at your celebrity listing, that would be like, yeah, that makes sense. Mine's all over the board.
Yeah.
I highly recommend a Tracee Ellis Ross because she gives you looks. She gives you laughs.
She's my fifth one. I do follow her.
She's great.
Yeah.
I love her. I don't know why I still follow Kim Kardashian. I need to link that.
Yeah, conversation is. And okay, can we switch gears?
Yes.
I want to get a little serious on you. I've been waiting for this update for a while. Ever since
we didn't even send off Scandal. Oh. Okay, we did, but go ahead.
Goodbye,
that's
Scandal.
All it deserved.
I mean, we did it. We never get to talk. I mean, this could be the last time we talk about Scandal. I'm sure it'll come back. Oh, but you know what I'm gonna do? This is what I'm gonna do. Watching Scandal this last year made me really realize how much I loved it. Its first 3.5 seasons.
Yes.
Is it 3.5? Because I mean, up to halfway through season 4. After she got kidnapped is when I was like,
Yeah, kidnapped is bad. I miss the procedurals. I miss like, ooh, what happened to this congressman?
Oh,
we need to fix it. I miss that shit.
Yeah. And also, it just like by the end, I feel like the theme was like, who's a monster? But you're all monsters. Like, and I like at the last minute, I won't tell you who they finally decided, like who the real monsters were. But it was like, you just decided that in 3 episodes. Like,
yeah, it's the truth. It's the truth.
I found, you know what? I read a very interesting article about Scandal and I'm like, oh, that's why all that happened. You want to know why the show
was it on Vulture?
Did you read that article about the writer's room? What were your
I did not.
Oh, it's fascinating. And it puts everything in perspective of like, oh, that's why the show is so fucking crazy. Let me give you a little tidbit about the writer's room of Scandal. So they did not know where the seasons were going.
That's not a good idea.
So they're literally writing episode to episode, and they're like, okay, well, Susan, she wrote this, and now I got to do this. And so they would paint them.
Yeah,
They'd write themselves into corners, which is why, like, different plot points would, 1 minute, this person's killing that person, the next minute, they're forgiving them, because different people are just taking what they had. Why someone gets shot
That's
6
bad.
Times and still survives, because they didn't know where it was going, and they're just, they hadn't.
That's bad.
Yeah. And so that's why it would happen. And they also, like, the reason why season 2 got so crazy, which is that was the season 2 and 3, was because they didn't know they were going to be brought back, so they knew that they had these plot points that they wanted to do, and they're like, gotta stuff them in.
Oh my god, that's not good. But you need to have an overall vision and an end goal,
right? I think they knew how they Shonda said she knew how she wanted the show to end, but getting
she wanted to end like this last episode.
I guess so. That was the
yikes.
Not please.
I mean, it was satisfying.
I'm gonna go back. I think what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna go back and actually watch the first. I'm gonna go back and watch. I think seasons 1, 2, 3 and half of 4 are really good. And
how do you have this time?
I don't.
I got so many other shows.
Oh, well, that's nothing else.
Westworld just started again.
Oh god, that was confusing. I didn't realize how much I didn't remember anything that happened last season.
I know. I paused it at one point after the recap, and I turned to Andrew and I was like, oh, I forgot about half of this stuff.
I thought I just remembered like they were were robots in the West. And I was like, I got it.
There's so much more. And then I had to remember and I was like, oh, that's right. One complaint.
Yes.
Why they gotta scalp the Native American? There's so many fucking other dead robots lying around, and they pick the Native American to brutally scalp.
You're so right.
And what the fuck,
yeah.
HBO?
Yeah, that's true. That is
but
true.
But they did show some dong, and I'm not mad at
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there was dong for life. Get your dong on, and that hashtag, they're doing it. Thank you, hashtag MeToo, because now we're getting dong in our face. Okay.
Stop it,
Time's
James.
Up for that dong. Is that too much?
That was, that's, okay. I'm not supporting right. that. That's, the views of this podcast is individual and individual.
I'm just spitballing here, just, you know.
Yeah, it's good, yeah.
Just trying out my joke. So we had to, after we watched the first episode, me and Maury and her husband Chris, we had to watch two different recaps to like
of Westworld
season one, because we forgot all the shit that had happened. And you know what? It's been 2 years. Like, it's been almost 2 years. And so
Jesus. And they just expect us to jump right in and know who the fuck is that and what they are and who they're
Michael
doing
Creighton
and what
plots. Like, Jesus.
I know.
Oh man. So now Scandal, we've sent it off.
Goodbye, Scandal. We loved you.
Switching gears, I want to go back. I have an update, and I have been waiting. I knew when I first did this corner, I knew that I was like, one day I'm going to do an update about this. And the day has finally come.
Yay!
So, episode 6. Oof.
Shit.
120 episodes ago.
Back when we had Obama as our president, you still lived on the West Coast.
Yes.
I was a non-married woman.
Yes, you were just, what would they call them?
A tax status single.
Yeah. You were, I keep wanting to say all kinds of things that are not. I was like, floozy.
I know. I don't even know what you're, this is, what are you trying to?
It's all about Westworld. got into
none
me.
None of those, a floozy or a Jezebel. Those are the only two things.
Doesn't that mean single woman? I don't
know. No, oh. Grandma.
You're so right. An unmarried woman in her 30s. A floozy.
Or a Jezebel. What's next? You're going to call me a spinster? When you were spinstering it up?
Oh my
God. You dumb librarian.
That's like, no. Sort of the tangent. This is just tangent city again. We are back in
manufacturing. I know.
So we had game night, and we were playing Old Maid. And you know what's really fucked up? Old Maid, she's probably, what, 26? You know?
Ew,
isn't that
I know.
Fucked up? They're like, she's an old maid. She's 26. Everybody calm down.
That's like, that's one of those Jane Austen books. I think it's Pride and Prejudice, where it's like they're the two daughters have to be married off because they're just too old and nobody's going to want them. And like, they're like 24.
Stop it. That's ridiculous. I can't handle this. Anyways, episode 6. I talked about Michael Johnson, a.k.a. Tiger Mandingo.
Yes.
Yes.
This is, we're doing our own Westworld right now. Everybody listening is going to be like, I don't even, what?
And to make it even more confusing, you can also hear this interview done on episode 52, where we did a Frankenstein episode of our greatest hits.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So,
okay, so just a recap.
Yes.
He is the man that that had sex with a lot of people and spread the HIV virus. Did I get that right?
You are almost, yes. Yes. So in 2013, he was arrested and then sent off to prison. He went to Lynwood University in Missouri, and he was sentenced to 30.5 years in prison.
Right.
And also to revisit this, and there's a lot of, I invite you to go back and listen to the episode, because we go in more in
depth. Go listen.
Of just how racism was playing into it, and that some people had maybe found out and knew that he was HIV positive. Also, everybody is responsible for also making sure that they are protected when they are having sex. This is also before like PrEP was as prevalent. This is like 2013.
Right.
So,
and he had some mental disabilities.
He was dyslexic when he was told that he was he was also illiterate. And he was also, when he was informed that he was HIV positive, no one really told him what that meant, because the sex educational department was not existent at that university. A lot of fucked up things happened. Also, I don't think I talked about this last time, but I just found out that his jury, maybe I did talk about this, the jury that sentenced him was a jury of all white straight dudes.
So no peers. No peers. Yeah. It was not a jury of peers. Also, James, one question, just because I forget. Yeah. And if I forget, then I'm sure the audience doesn't remember. How did the name Mandingo get folded in again?
Yes. So he got the name Tiger Mandingo because he was a wrestler and that was his name.
Right.
And he was given this name. The Mandingo, we unpacked that terminology.
We did.
It's, horribly racist.
Go listen. You did a beautiful job unpacking that.
But he got it because that was he was also doing ball culture and he would walk in the sort of like sexy man part of the ball culture. And so he was, hypersexualized on all fronts, And so there's an update to what happened. And I was looking I knew one day I was doing an update and that is today. So,
ta-da!
So, in 2016, a Missouri appeals court overturned that conviction, ruling that the prosecuting attorney, Philip, had failed to barely disclose evidence to Johnson's trial, right? So then in 2017, Johnson agreed to a 10-year no contest, plea deal rather than forced for the trial. And actually, when he first was getting convicted, his lawyer was like, 30 years is too much. Like, can he do 10 years? In Missouri, you only get 7 years for drunk driving. If you kill someone while drunk driving, it's only 7 years.
Vehicular manslaughter. Yes,
good word. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then last month, Johnson appeared before the Missouri Board of Probation and Parole, and he learned that his parole had been granted.
Oh, wow. So he's free?
Well, here's the catch.
Oh, okay.
So he must remain incarcerated for another 18 months. He won't be released until October of 2019, almost 6 years after he was originally locked away. And if this release goes as planned, he will have served about 60% of his 10-year sentence. Yeah. So... yeah, so there's that.
It's not 30 years.
It's not 30 years. I am relieved. I also said in one episode I was going to write him a prison letter, and I hoped everybody else would as well. I didn't, so I need
your window is slowly closing.
I got it. Yeah, don't let him get out before he gets my letter.
Maybe... Yeah.
He needs to get my letter. So I just wanted to give...
I don't know what to do with that. I'm just like...
I just wanted to give that update. Again, it was just the amount of racism that was involved in that. And also, we need to revisit our laws. Like, there's still such penalty and laws around HIV stigmatization, that there's huge sentencing. These laws were created in the 80s and HIV is not a death sentence. Everyone's responsible for also protecting themselves and also disclosing their information as well.
I think that this story brings up so many different issues that we still need to talk about. One, education. Yeah. Education to the person when they have the disease, the virus. And two, education on people on how to protect themselves. Yeah. Three, how to properly educate our populations. Like, to have somebody go through the educational system and still be illiterate. Not getting the proper, care and service that they deserve in order to be able to function in our society. Mm-hmm. The stereotypes of hypersexualizing black men in the straight and gay community. Mm-hmm. It really he is the cross-section of all of that stuff.
Oh my
gosh,
all of those conversations. It is a huge, huge story. So I would love to have him on the show when he gets out, obviously, and talk to him about...
Sure, yeah. You hunt him down, get him.
Get him. And you know what? Also, because I wanted to point, there's this guy in Britain, Daryl Rao, who he intentionally... infected men in England with HIV. He was intentionally doing it. And so he got sentenced to life in prison, but he was intentionally doing it, would send them messages of I lied about my status. I have HIV, and so it's interesting because when I heard that story, I'm like, oh, but that's not what Michael Johnson did,
Right, so, right. Fascinating. Yeah. Thanks for the update. Yeah. It's always fun. I feel like we're like a legit podcast now, giving updates right. about our like past stories.
Also, and it made me realize something else. How much I miss recording in the same room as you.
I know. We are like all giggles when we do that. But you're coming over to the West Coast in soon.
No.
I mean, in a few months.
Right. We'll talk about that. I was supposed to be coming to film film Shit and Champagne, the movie, but that got postponed until February 2019.
Oh, so you're not coming this summer.
But I decided that for my birthday, I'm probably going to come to the Bay Area for 2 weeks. So,
So you are coming.
Yeah. I had to take you on
a journey.
That's
a roundabout way of you just being like, yes.
I had to take you on my journey that I also went on. I'm a storyteller. You did. It's what I do.
Yeah, you are. You just took me up and ride along. That was
you took care of the adventure. Well, speaking of riding along, shall we ride along to your corner, Miss Thang?
Let's do it.
Should The Rock run for president? How about Oprah?
Why was Pitch canceled?
Does Ryan Murphy ever sleep?
Settle a bet for me. Who's hotter, The Thing or Squirrel Girl?
How can I take part in the summer book club?
For answers to these questions and so much more, come on over to Pop Rocket, a pop culture roundtable show with me, Guy Branum,
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Thompson.
Catch us every Wednesday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you decide to get your podcasts. I'm not going to judge.
A naked corner. What you got, mama? It's a naked corner.
So we're going to bring it down a little bit because it's a serious issue, but I really wanted to talk about it.
Yes.
I'm going to be quoting from a couple of articles that I found and enjoyed. Well, not enjoyed, but they informed me, I guess is a better term to say, you know?
Yes.
Because I don't want to, you know. I wasn't like,
this is so much fun. It's just like, thank you. I appreciate being informed. You know what? Knowledge is fun. I mean, knowledge is like, it's empowering.
It's good. It feels good to know.
Yeah, you're like, I know shit.
Even if the topic is depressing. So.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I get you.
So a little sliver of hope. I was, it goes up and down. So I was reading in one of my favorite blogs that I like to frequent, Feministing. Check it out if you get a chance. And in this article, it's called Impotential Feminist Win Argentina Considers Legalizing Abortion. It is by Amanda R. Matos, M-A-T-O-S. So check it out. I am pulling a lot of quotes from there. So basically, to kind of give you a background, legal abortion in Argentina may actually become a reality this year, which is exciting, thanks to lawmakers and activists who have been fighting for decades to frame abortion as a human right. A lot of countries, especially Catholic countries, outlaw abortion, and I'll get into that a little bit later. So in Argentina, abortion is legal only if the pregnancy was caused by rape, the mother's health is at risk, or the fetus has congenital birth defects. And that may sound like a handful of reasons, but it's not. Like, literally, rape, mother's health, a fetus has congenital birth defects. Everything else, gotta have that baby. Right. Which is problematic. Mm-hmm. If a woman seeks an abortion outside of these parameters, she can be fined or jailed. And just to give an example, in 2014, three Argentinian women were incarcerated with issues relating to abortion. One for having an abortion and two for helping their friend have the abortion. She basically was arrested for the homicide of a blood relative.
Wow. What? Okay.
Yeah, all right. Just process that for a minute.
That's a lot.
Right? So this is what we're working with. So basically,
I can even I could even see, like, I know you said that, like, one of the causes is, like, one of the, it's illegal in terms of rape, but I could see, like, that. Mm-hmm. I just knowing how our even police force work. I mean, mm-hmm. I could even see it being hard for a woman to even prove that that had happened. You know, like that.
For sure.
Right?
And like when I get into, I'm going to go into other countries that where abortion is illegal. There's different breakdowns, and there are countries that don't even have that stipulation. Just no matter what.
You gotta have the kid.
Yeah. Exactly.
They're on that philosophy of, like, remember that stupid senator who was like, a woman's body could, if she's raped, it'll make it so it won't have the baby. Do you remember that guy?
No, but that guy sounds like an
idiot.
That's, yeah. Ugh, God. And anyways, moving on. Yeah. And this fact was brought up in the same article. Basically, according to the Argentine government, there are between 370,000 and 522,000 illegal abortions every year, making up about one third of maternal deaths nationwide and nearly 60% hospitalizations. Now, this is another reason that even if you are pro-life, this is one reason to think about being pro-choice. And I say pro-choice, a lot of people think that pro-choice is pro-abortion. It is not. Pro-choice just means you are pro-women having the choice to do whatever the fuck they want to do with their bodies, which sounds pretty good to me. What happens a lot when abortion is illegal is underground abortions happen.
Right.
And they are brutal. They are terrible. Mm. They're done in shitty, dark, dirty, awful places where women die. This happened in America. This happens everywhere to this day. It's just like, and this is a terrible example, but just like how people are talking about the epidemic of people getting illegal butt injections and how they are dying from that. Oof. That's just somebody injecting something into your body. Now imagine somebody in the same sort of situation where you're just going to somebody's home in on their bed, not properly sterilizing, going into you to give you an abortion is terrifying, and women are risking their lives to go through this. So this is dire concerns.
Yeah, I mean that scene in what's that Spike Lee show recently?
She's got to have it.
Oh, that scene was horrific.
Yeah, where a woman goes and gets a butt injection.
And that was just, and like you were saying, that was just a butt injection. Like, and an abortion, even more intrusive and more dangerous.
Exactly. So, in good news, in March, Argentina's Congress launched public hearings to decide whether or not to legalize abortion up to 14 weeks. The bill itself was introduced in the lower house of Argentina's Congress, and women lawmakers responded to overwhelming public support to ensure the bill is also supported in the upper house. Over the next 2 months, a special commission will meet on a bi-weekly basis to consider the abortion bill. It's probably going to be an uphill battle to do this, but the fact that they're even talking about it, the fact that they're considering it, is hope that it is going to happen. So activists hope that this new bill will not only provide legal protection for women seeking abortions, but begin to normalize this life-saving procedure. Like, that's what needs to happen, is it needs to be normalized and it needs to be seen in the light of, look, abortions save lives. Like, yeah, you may be thinking about the abortion and, you know, the theoretical life that's happening in an abortion. But one, it's up to debate when life happens. And two, this woman is a vital life. You know, this is her body. This is her thing. I encourage people to start thinking about the women and instead of the fetus, as cold as that sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I just, like, for myself, it's one of those, this is like a great, this is like me, like I just sit in my ally seat, because I just feel like for myself, all I can do is just really listen to women and like how I can support them. And for myself, is it weird that I just think like, I just think that men, not like, I feel like men need to not talk in this conversation. And I just feel like the women, y'all sit around and you figure, what do you want to do? And I trust the conversations that the women are having and that you all know what's best. Cause like I'm not going to carry a child from, I will never, you know, like I.
Right. Thank you. Like, I agree.
And,
so,
and it's like, and then for me, it's like all the women get together, you talk and you decide. And then us men folk, we're going to support whatever decision that you guys, you all, you ladies come up with. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. And on a lesser degree, that's how I feel about circumcision. I don't have a dick, so I'm not going to say what people need to do with dicks. So you know, like that's of course a lesser degree, but like, it's my body. Don't tell me what to do with my body. You know?
Yeah.
Thanks, James. I appreciate your allyship. That's how to be an ally. And that's how I feel I need to act when I'm sitting in the ally seat, you know? But I do. I mean, this is our podcast.
Remember, you're the intern. You shut up and listen.
Give me my coffee.
That's it. That's what I'm here to do, ladies. What you need? You want cream and sugar in that?
Okay, so here is a potential way that Argentina could end up. So, in an article called How Chile Ended Its Draconian Ban on Abortions by Jose Miguel Vivano and Veronica Ehrenrad. Yeah.
I have a question. Yeah. Me. I raised my, for the listeners who can't see us, I raised my hand. I do have a lot. In rehearsal, I always raise my hand if I have a question. What is that about? Okay. When the people say draconian, I don't know what that fully means. And people use that a lot.
Good question. Draconian, what I understand as I'm looking it up.
Because I know it's a term that gets used a lot.
Yeah. It means oppressive.
Right. But is it referring to like a specific era of like, I think of Game of Thrones, but I don't feel like it came from
that. Yeah, because of dragons. Give me a minute. Yeah. I am looking it up. I spelled it wrong, and now I'm just getting this thing that's for vampire freaks. Draconian. Here we go.
Live Googling. Okay. Be careful. That's like earlier I Googled Mandingo and I was like,
yikes. Okay, so basically, and like I said, it's the law of their applications, excessive, harsh, and severe. So terrible. I wonder why it comes from that. It could be, let's see. I mean, what's the etymology of draconian?
Yeah.
There's probably somebody that was named Draco that was like a dick.
I just wanted to make sure I was the only person who didn't. Oh, yeah, what?
Draconian comes from
a corner within a corner.
Yeah, this is. And this is from Merriam-Webster, so you can trust it. Draconian comes from Draco, the name of a 17th century BC Athenian legislator who created a written code of law. Draco's code was intended to clarify pre-existing laws, but its severity is what made it really memorable. He was like, you die, or if you don't pay your debts, you're a slave. Like, Draco was a dick. Draco was, a jerk.
Also, just to point out in our episodes, the similarities, which timeline are we in? Mm-hmm. Do you know that in the episode where we talk about Mandingo in episode 6, we also reference Merriam-Webster?
What, we do? Oh,
yes.
All right.
We literally like, Merriam says. So.
We are right on cue. We are doing good. All right. So how Chile ended its draconian ban on abortion. And it was draconian because basically they didn't let anybody have, like, they were like, you got raped, too bad, you got to have that baby. You're 10, too bad, you got to have that baby. Like, you're going to die, too bad, you're going to have that baby. Like, that's why it was draconian, because it was. And also, librarian note. Always notice the tone and the language that the person is writing. I mean, the fact that somebody wrote How Chile Ended Its Draconian Ban on Abortion, you know that this is going to be a pro-life article.
Look at you.
Looking at the language will inform you to the point of view of the writer.
Which is important to also just be able to have that filter to go through so you understand that's the lens that you're looking at this information from, which should also encourage you to also find an article from someone else as well.
Balance your opinions. Balance it. Yeah. And it is an opinion piece from the New York Times. But just in case you want a little research tip, that there you go. But they did, so they gave some good facts. So basically they said that there was a huge victory for Chile's women. The Constitutional Court he upheld a long-awaited law that eases the total ban on abortion, raising hope that other Latin American cultures will soon, or countries, will soon reconsider their cruel restrictions on procedure. The new Chilean law passed by Congress in August decriminalizes abortion under three circumstances: if the life of the pregnant woman is at risk, if the pregnancy is a result of a rape, or the fetus will not survive. Notice that is a glimmer of hope for Chile, because it was even worse than that. And at Argentina, they're starting at that level. So there's different levels of the legality of abortion. Yeah. And I think we all need to take that into consideration, because it's, even if it is, okay, you can get an abortion here, look at the parameters, because a lot of women are still at risk. So I wanted to point that out. Now, to finalize what I've been talking about, I pulled out a nifty little map.
Ooh, and I love maps.
It is from reproductiverights.org. I will be linking it. And it's old. It's from 2014. So
That was way back then.
I know. It probably needs to be updated. But because abortion laws take so long to overturn and to change, depressingly, I'm pretty sure that a lot of these countries are still the same.
Yeah, actually, I was making sarcastic when I said that. I thought you were going to say I have a map from like 1984. Yeah. You know, like sometimes in schools, like schools that don't have like the updated maps.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I remember my history book still said like the Soviet Union for a while.
Oh, yeah, the USSR. Yeah.
Yes.
No, I know. Okay, so there are four different categories that abortion laws are filed under for countries. There is number one, to save a woman's life or prohibited altogether. These are in red. And I just want to read some of these because I'm sure some of you guys out there listening probably have some myths, some ideas of what country you think will permit it and doesn't permit it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, there's in this category. So basically, this is only if it saves a woman's life or it's prohibited altogether. So these are red alert countries. Afghanistan, Antigua and Barbuda, Brazil. Barbuda. No, Barbados is different.
You said Bermuda? I didn't hear what the country was.
No, Barbuda.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know where that is.
It's Antigua, basically. It's like the same island, but they divide it in half. El Salvador, Egypt, Guatemala, Malta. So yes, Europe, you're in there too.
Yeah.
Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Mexico, Papua New Guinea, Paraguay, Uganda, the Solomon Islands, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and I'm skipping around too. United Arab Emirates, Venezuela, and West Bank and the Gaza Strip. So those are some countries that it is terrible. You know, women have no rights, basically.
Well, I would be interested to look at like how the perceptions of women are and the role of women in those countries and how those maybe correlate, you know? Just an interesting sort of...
there's that too. Yeah, and also there's the role of women and also the religion and then also some other things too, because if we go into the next level, this is a little bit more surprising. This is level two, to preserve health, which is the category that Argentina is in. Mm-hmm. So basically this is the only, remember those numbers that I told you about, all the thousands, hundreds of thousands of women that are dying because they aren't allowed to get abortions unless it is to preserve health.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which is a lot. So Argentina's in there. The Bahamas are in there. Colombia, Chad, Ecuador, Ethiopia, Israel, Jamaica, New Zealand, Northern Ireland, Poland, Peru, Rwanda, St. Kitts, Samoa, Swaziland, and Trinidad and Tobago.
My people.
Yeah, well, my people and your people are in the same boat with that one. And then I also want to point out there's there's a third category called socioeconomic grounds. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that this plays a part into if you cannot afford to have a child.
I didn't know that was, yeah, okay. That's what I would interpret that as. But yeah. I'm surprised that that's an option.
There's not a lot in there, but
okay. And I feel like even in the U.S., that's not an option.
Well, we're listed as the last category, thankfully.
Okay,
but
right, but I feel like there's probably even doesn't it change those state to state in some of the levels
or
something?
I mean, yeah, you would think. So but also it's another parameter where people can say maybe not. No, you can afford it. That's what. Like what you're saying, it's a squishy area. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It gives a little bit of a leeway to say, like, nah, you can't have an abortion.
Well, and that just, I know you're going to jump to the U.S., but my whole entire thing about the U.S. is like, if all these people were like, I'm jumping the gun here, but I always like, especially these people who are like, let's save the children, but like, they also don't want taxes so we can support these fucking children.
Exactly.
So that always aggravates me because it's like, you care, like you say you care about the children, but you don't. Like,
exactly.
There's no programs for these children, for people who like really can't have this child.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying for them to have it, they're like, okay, I'll have it, but I need you we as a community need to then step in and take care of this child and have funding and programs and schools and housing for them.
I know. So before we get to there, and I'm so glad you brought up that point because that's a big and important part, but there are a lot of countries that surprised me that are in this category, this one where it's basically squishy with the socioeconomic grounds. So that means that there are restrictions. You can't just go get an abortion.
Right.
Finland, Great Britain, Hong Kong, Iceland, India, Japan, Taiwan, and then Barbados, Belize, and some other places. But those places to me are still restricting what women can do with their bodies.
Sure. Who's left? Like, I feel like
a lot of people.
All the countries. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. It's an interesting map. I highly suggest you look at it because, of course, it's a hot button issue right now, especially with Mike Pence, who is very much against abortion and could throw us into the red category easily. But right now we thankfully, knock on wood, we're in without restriction as to reason. There's some restriction as to the date or the
okay, that's what it, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah, the like gestation time.
Right.
But you don't have to have a say, nah, you can't do this.
You can't do that
for
a
reason, which is beautiful.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, there's like Australia, Belgium,
Canada.
Canada's in there. China,
France?
Croatia. France is in there.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Where does Russia fit into this?
Russia is in there with us.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mongolia, Norway, Puerto Rico, Vietnam, South Africa, you know, Guyana. I don't know why Puerto Rico's listed. Well, Puerto Rico is like Guam, where it's United States,
right?
But it's like a colony, kind of. I hate to say like, colony, but that's
sort of like the
like they're considered America, but they're not. They can't vote,
right?
And it's a territory. That's the better place. It's
territory.
A better way of saying it, quote unquote.
Right?
You know, so
same. Yeah,
Cuba is in there with us. So there's a lot of people, thankfully, that do allow it. It really does.
That don't. And that puts, there's a lot of countries that don't. It really puts a lot of women at risk. It puts, like, if we're trying to save lives, but you're also just murdering lives because if these women are still going to go through with it, it's going to be the life, depending on where your definition of life is.
Completely.
If you're
not
saying,
to mention,
you're trying to save that,
and this is a
fetus,
whole nother like, story,
woman,
but a study just
lives
came
are
out
be
that
lost.
Black
you know,
women
that
are
sense?
Disproportionately more likely to die during birth than any other woman in America. Not depending, like, you can be rich or poor, live in rural or city. It's always across the board. Black women are most likely to die during childbirth, which is insane to me.
Yeah. And in fact, the U.S. Mm-hmm. sadly has a very, like, for what the U.S. is part of yes. the industrialized yeah, yeah, nation
yeah.
that we are.
Yeah,
we
I know. Very,
there's the birth, the
for a developed birth, nation, it just doesn't.
Birth, mm-hmm. death rate.
Not to is mention that, developed right? nation is
it's
squishy,
high.
Too. Like,
it's higher than it needs to be.
It's just, I
that's
mean.
That's the word, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. I was trying to find the right. What do we call
it? A country that has not been destroyed by colonialism. Like,
I mean,
anyways.
You said earlier we got colonies.
Just one thing, a couple things to think about, a couple of things to be thankful for the way that we have right now, for the Supreme Court ruling, and also to kind of challenge your notion of what pro-choice and what pro-life brings to the table.
Welcome, everyone, to the live wrestling spectacular in Los Angeles.
So far, the world's most boring wrestling podcast has been destroying the competition.
Isn't there anyone who can save us from this travesty?
Wait, could it be?
It's Tights and Fights, the perfect wrestling podcast.
Tights and Fights is here to save us from the monotony of boring wrestling podcasts with hilarious conversations.
Woke trips through the history of wrestling.
And joke about the finer points of people wearing spandex.
What a match!
And the Tights and Fights podcast will be back every week.
Thursdays on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get podcasts. Please, these hosts have families.
Tights and Fights podcast. Tights and Fights.
Right, we want to welcome to the show. I feel like you know you need no introduction. Duray, I feel like you're like one name like Beyonce, you know, that people just know you, at least I do, just by the one name. You're a former school teacher turned co-host of your podcast, Pod Save the People, activist, social justice warrior, dare I say, a politician. I just want to jump right into it. So 2014 seems to be a huge sort of pivotal year. Wouldn't you agree that for a lot of us Black folks and people around the country, you know, we started this podcast because of a lack of diversity in voices, specifically ones handling issues around, you know, the violence that was happening to Black and brown bodies and to intersectionality as well. You once said that you're not born woke, something wakes you up. So what happened for you in 2014?
Yeah, I think a lot about this idea that we aren't born woke, but something wakes us up. And for me, it was the death of Mike Brown that I saw that a young boy had been killed in St. Louis, and I was like, I got to figure out what I can do to make sure this never happens again. I was sitting in my apartment in Minneapolis, and I got in the car, drove 9 hours, ended up in Ferguson, and sort of the rest is history. But for me, it was like, I talked a lot about how do we live our commitments. And it was like the least I can do was like go for a weekend. That's what I was going to do, is like go see what happened for myself. I saw what was happening on CNN. It looked like the crazy protesters on Twitter. It looked like the crazy police. And I was like, the least I can do is just go try and help. And 2 days turned into, you know, 400 days and 4 years.
I talk about having the bravery and courage to just drop everything that you were already doing and just to jump in. And your life has just taken, it's been a nonstop turn ever since then, and really leading towards what your life's work and mission is here. You know, it's funny, coming full circle, we actually talked about episode 11, this is episode 123 now, but way back when we first were started on episode 11, we had talked about Campaign Zero, which is your 10-point policy plan that you and a few others helped develop. Where do you think that we are? And maybe you can talk to our audience a little bit about the 10-point policy, which is about what that's about a bit more. And where do you think that we are in terms of moving the needle and getting those policies implemented?
Yeah, this acknowledgement that like, systemic problems require systemic solutions. So we were trying to figure out, like, what are the structural things that allow the police to sort of get away? Often we think about, like, the personal solutions. So, like, this bad prosecutor, this bad individual police officer, this bad governor, this bad lawmaker. And we were like, what are the structural things? So came with the 10-point plan, looking at all the research that had been out there, looking at all the demands from protesters across the country. It was the first national platform to come out in the protest. And two things that I'll talk about, we created the first public database of use of force policies and the first public database of police union contracts both have been impactful. And we did it publicly because we wanted to show activists and organizers around the country, like, here are the things at the local level that really could be a game changer in the way the police operate. There are 18,000 police departments in the country. A third of all the people killed by a stranger in this country is killed by a police officer. So the work has to continue because we know that the crisis is still here.
And so that's interesting. You know, and then speaking to, you know, just 2 years ago, I think it's so fascinating where your work has led you to. You ran for mayor of Baltimore in 2016. What was that experience like?
Yeah, so I learned a lot. You know, it is, you know, this is before, I ran before Trump, right? So now everybody's running for office and everybody thinks running for office is sort of a good thing. But back then, there were a lot of people who I thought would be like, oh, running for offices. And they were like, you know, you're going to be a part of the system and like you're a sellout. And so that was sort of interesting. Learned a lot about fundraising. There's nothing, it's like basic organizing, right? There's nothing that can compete or compare with like just meeting people wherever they are. So in hindsight, you know, I probably wouldn't have done as many forums and things like that and just like had done more door knocking with all the time I had. So learned a lot. I'm excited about working on some other campaigns as time continues and maybe running for office one day later.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny that you said that because, I mean, you were ahead of the time. You know, I think it's so interesting how different that election might have happened in the post-Trump world. Do you think it would have gone differently?
Oh, I don't know. I try not to hypothesize. I do think that I just know the energy around what it means to run is just completely different. You know, I'll never forget. I did a fundraiser in New York and it was like front page news. It was like, how dare he raise money not in the city that he's from, right? Like that was like, it was a scandal to people. There were people in neighborhoods who were like, I'll never vote for him because he's like raising money in New York City. Today, that's like not a, that's a non-story, right? Like people are donating across the country. People are raising money across the country. It's like a normal thing, but you know, when I ran, it wasn't a normal thing. So I do think that like moving forward, it'll just be different for everybody, but I learned a ton.
Yeah, total trailblazer. How interesting what happens during different cultural climates and just the difference that 2 years makes. Something else that you did recently that I thought I was trying to get tickets, but my scheduling just went crazy. You did an event with Brené Brown. She's the author of Daring Greatly, which we actually did a segment about that book, Daring Greatly. How did that come up? You're doing a talk with Brené Brown.
Yeah, so I tweeted something about sort of hopelessness and negativity, and she just responded. So we had a long Twitter exchange, sort of going back and forth. And I love Brené's work, and we went back and forth, and it was a good conversation. And then the people at Riverside reached out, and they were like, "Would you be willing to do this conversation sort of publicly about race?" And it was like, "Absolutely!" So we did it at Riverside. We put it recently up as a podcast, and Brené's been great. Learned a lot about her with regard to like vulnerability, shame, and guilt. I think we're going to do another event soon to like help people just understand the issues a little bit better.
Yeah. I was reading her book, Daring Greatly, and ran into a guy on the train who we ended up he went to your event. And I think it was so interesting because it brought such different worlds of people together that maybe weren't usually having dialogue or conversations with each other. How do you feel that, like, so you're familiar with her work. So how do you feel for like the Black community or even Black queer folks? Like, how do you think that, because her book doesn't really touch into this. So how do you feel that shame and vulnerability impacts us differently than maybe more than other folks?
Yeah, so she thinks about shame as like the idea that you're a bad person. Guilt is like you're a person who's done sort of bad things or who's made mistakes. So we talked a lot about like the difference between sort of white shame and white guilt. That was interesting. I think about people of color, you know, one of the reasons why we believe that structural problems require structural solutions is that like the opposite would be that people just made people made decisions that led them to poverty. People, like individual people, made decisions that led them to be illiterate. And it's like, no, these are things that happen at the structural level. So I do think that there's like a layer of the way people of color experience guilt and shame that like there's like a shame of being poor. It's like, well, you actually didn't, like the fact that your family has never had wealth is not actually the result of like personal decisions. Like that's just not true. You know, we gave white people wealth, we didn't give it to Black people, and like that was a choice. So I think about that often, and like the cost of vulnerability. Like, what do you know, pessimism, we talked about this sort of on stage, right? Is that pessimism is sort of easier for people who have tried and tried and like the world never got better, right? So instead of experiencing pain later, they just sort of say, well, it's all screwed anyway. So, and that's sort of an easier place. Vulnerability is really hard. And you know, she writes a lot about this. So like vulnerability opens you up to the possibility of pain in the midst of joy. And like, that's not something that a lot of people want to experience, especially when you've lived a life filled with so much trauma already.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's something too, you know, that you said the word trauma. I think it's something that I've been looking into even more, just of how I think that we've not really unpacked how much trauma that we passed on from generation to generation, even generations that are still living. You know, we recently talked about on the podcast how there were something of like 750 riots that happened between the years of 1963 and 1971. And so, I mean, there are people who are still alive in these cities and communities of Detroit and LA that, I mean, no wonder it must have had such an effect on the communities and the people that are still living there. And I think we don't think about the effect that it had on those people.
Yeah, and not just that, right? Like the legacy of slavery is not so far gone. The legacy of Jim Crow is not so far gone, right? That these things still have a living impact on people, and because the problem is still alive, the solutions have to be alive, and like that has to be how we think about it. So people ask me all the time, like, why are you making it about race? And it's like, race is making it about me. Like, I would love to not be in the street, right? Like, I'd love to not have the only way that we can get people to pay attention to a crisis is to create a crisis, right? That, like, would love for those not to be real, but that is sort of where we are. And because that's the battleground we're on, like that's sort of how we have to fight.
Well, and I think that people look back on history with very sort of rose-colored glasses. You know, they often look at, you know, Dr. King. All they do is kind of remember the dream parts of his conversations and speeches. But I mean, a lot of the protests and things that happened in the 60s, there was a lot of, because there was violence that was happening to the Black community, there was having, and not that all of them were violent in nature, but I think that people kind of forget that the change didn't happen just because people were passively or peacefully marching and protesting. There was very, you know, there were the sit-ins, there were the things that were doing, that were disrupting people's day-to-day to make them look at things. Even the abolitionists had to go to extremes to get people to wake up and get them to be uncomfortable. Comfortable, because otherwise change isn't going to happen if people are just nice and complacent, you know?
Yeah, you know, it is one of those things that, like, what happens when you make people fight for survival? Like, that there are consequences to that. Like, I'm interested too in like how we start to think about what it means to win. Like, you know, the further that we've gotten away from the very first days of protest, like, I'm just like, you know, spend all day and all night trying to think about, like, what does it actually mean to win? That we've shifted the conversation, that we've totally changed a public conversation about race and justice and identity, which is not in and of itself changing the structures, right? So how do we make sure that we don't get seduced by the fact that conversation's happening? That, like, the win is that, like, people experience the system differently. The win is that the system, like, functions on people's lives differently. The win is that, like, you and I don't have to sit up and talk about homophobia and racism and mass incarceration anymore because they aren't problems. And we get to go do other things with our lives that aren't focusing on the trauma every day. Like, that is what it means to win.
Yeah. What a world that would be, you know. And you know, it's interesting too that, like, you know, I am appreciating that there are more people who are actively partaking in the conversations in resistance or running for you know, political office or whatnot. You know, but there still have some people who are still on the sidelines so much. Who are just like, well, I have my own personal traumas that I'm still working for, and it's like, you don't think the people that marched across the bridge down in Selma weren't traumatized, you know, that there's never a time when people are not dealing with trauma. Like, human experience has been traumatized, and it'd be nice to be in a place where we did have that peace, but we're not there yet, and people have to roll up their sleeves.
Yeah, and you know, people, it's funny, people will say, like, you know, is it the artist's job to sort of interpret struggle? And it's like, well, when's a moment where there hasn't been struggle, right? Like, if that's the artist's job right now, then that's sort of always the artist's job, because in communities of color, like, that's always an experience. One of the things I worry about with sort of the Trump effect on sort of protest is, while everybody's protesting now, which is important, because Lord knows there's enough to sort of push back against, there is, among some people, they believe that, like, the history of injustice began with the Muslim ban, right? They're like, wow, the country got bad. And you're like, country's bad for a lot of people way before the Muslim ban, right? So trying to make sure that, like, people keep this same energy that when Trump isn't president, when the trauma isn't spread in the way that it's spread today.
Because, like, that's the thing is that these issues have always been here. It's not like there's been a massive, like, before Trump and then after Trump. Like, a lot of these policies were already kind of there, which made it so easy for him to push it to the forefront.
Yeah, the issues were there. And, like, you know, he's using the federal government in ways that, like, you know, we hadn't imagined. So that is sort of different. And like, we'll see sort of what the impact is overall. Hopefully this is just 4 years, which seems like longer than anybody. You know, it's just like a wild thing to even have to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I kind of still have not fully admitted that he is the president, that it's kind of like, not like I'm burying my head in the sand, but just trying to move forward and just looking forward and not looking up, if that kind of, that analogy makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's real. Yeah, and it's hard because, like, that's sort of what he wants us to do, right? Is sort of just, like, try to just hunker down. And, like, people of color, we've always had to hunker down, right? Like, that's been a strategy for a long time. So I'm hopeful that we will, you know, in 2018, that we'll be able to get one House of Congress at least, so we can stop the legislative agenda from moving forward. It'd be powerful to get two. And you know, the states still have a lot of power. So, like, trying to think about how we can impact change at the local and state level is important as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So on that note, you know, and I guess even on a larger context, how do you feel people should get involved either in issues or being of service or making a difference? Like, what are some ideas that you have or some, you know, again, because what you did to me was so admirable. You gave up, you restarted your life. You gave up everything and that bravery and courage that it took to do that. So how can others follow in your footsteps or do things on a day-to-day level?
Yeah, you know, we launched ourstates.org, so that people could go and see, like, legislation across the country at the state level that was important for them to either be for or against. So, because we got this question a lot about, like, you know, I want to do something, just don't know the issue. So we did that. We did the police union contract work and the use of force policy, so people also could check them out. And that's at checkthepolice.org and useofforceproject.org. But I'm reminded that, like, all the best organizing starts small. It's like a couple people getting together saying, I think this thing is sort of an issue. And then doing the research so they know the issue well, that, like, it's hard for you to fight and be an advocate for things that you just don't understand. So, you know, the first thing I did when I was in Ferguson, like, the very first thing I did was, like, made sandwiches. And we, like, talked about what we thought we should do. And, like, that was actually how it started. But people don't see that. People think of this in, like, grand terms. It's like, it actually normally starts, like, pretty chill and, like, pretty, or, like, just small. And then it grows. This work will always be more important than it is popular.
What I love about that is, like, just making, I mean, making sandwiches, like, you're just proving that everyone has something that they can contribute. And I think that's probably what's holding back a lot of people, is that they don't know how to get in. What's the access point? Or they feel like they have to, you know, do this huge brand, this grand gesture. But I mean, it can be something as small as that. What do you think that is holding people back from getting involved or yeah?
You know, I think that people want to play in, right? They sort of want to enter into something that already exists. I think that people are generally, like, afraid of creating things. So that makes sense. There'll always be a small group of people who are, like, the early adopters and, like, the originators, and a much larger group of people who come sort of on afterwards. I think about even the protests. There were not millions of us in the street at the very beginning. There were sort of later, which was powerful, but, like, at the very beginning, there were not. So I do think that curve sort of exists. And, you know, people, one of the ways that people in power maintain power is convincing you that you can't make an impact and that the system is just so complicated that you need to have, like, three PhDs and like, whatever to sort of make a difference. And, like, that's just not true. That you are an expert on the way you experience the systems, right? You're an expert on the way, like, your community works. Like, you actually have a set of experiences that allow you to have input, and people often just haven't been told that before. So when you think about what it means to empower people, it's like, I can't give you power. What I can do is, like, help you find the power you have. And, like, people have much more power than they believe.
Beautiful. Yep. You're so right about that. Where do you see, you know, moving forward for yourself? And who knows, because I'm sure if you would have asked yourself 10 years ago if this is where your life would be, I don't think you probably could have even predicted that. But do you see a trajectory for yourself? Like, where do you see your life's mission or your life's work taking you in the next 10 years? And what impact do you hope that your work has on society?
Yes, I'm one of many people who is trying to do good work around this issue. I am hopeful that we'll change systems and structures. Like, that's always the goal, that, like, we'll figure out how to push the levers that'll have the biggest impact, that is, like, why we do the work. And that's what I'm hoping for. So like I plan every day trying to think about like what's the most impactful thing I can do and help the people around me do those and how to empower as many people as possible to have the information so they don't have to go through me or anybody else. They can just do the work because we've created access for the information. And what you find with a lot of activists and organizers is that they have the organizing muscle and they have the energy, but sometimes just don't know the policies as well as they could, or definitely not as well as the other side. And like, we can fix that, that like, yeah, we're not a think tank in like the way that, a place with 30 employees is, which doesn't mean that the quality is any different. Like we just, are trying to support you in like new ways. So, you know, we can help the protesters in Austin be experts on the police union contract, or Portland, or cities across the country. So when they walk into meetings, they are like just as prepared or even better prepared than the people they sit across the table. And we've seen that actually be really powerful.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Like when I, you know, hear you talk and, you know, people in my circles, to me, it seems like the obvious choice is moving towards equality. Like, why do you think there's such resistance towards equality? Do they just not see it as equality? Do they, like, what is that resistance?
You know, King talks about the Voting Rights Act and Civil Rights Act, and he's like, it was easy for you to give them to us because it didn't cost you anything. That the things that are the biggest levers are the things that like have a cost, right? That like, you know, if we're going to actually close a racial wealth gap, people have to sort of change their relationship to the materials they currently have. If we're going to end mass incarceration, then people have to grapple with the fact that they just think black bodies are dangerous, right? Like, and there's a financial aspect to that because like a lot of people make money off the prison system. So like what you find is like people, their words convey something their actions don't. And like we want to challenge people on that, that like people are racist. People hold racist beliefs that like turn into racist policies. And like we want to name all of those things to expose them. What I'm excited about is there are more people, I think, who believe in a better world than who don't. The question is, like, can we organize them?
Sure, sure. And it's interesting that, like, in this day and age, suddenly to call someone a racist is one of the worst things that could, you know, they get so offended by it. Or to call, like, not maybe that they're a racist, but something that they said is racist. And that's the only way that you can sort of unpack that is by calling attention to it. I had someone who was like, I've only had two criticisms about Black Panther, and it came from two white people. And I'll try to unpack where some of those were some racist ideas, and they got so offended by that, and like it was the worst thing that I could have ever talked to that said to them. But it's like, but what you said is rooted in racism.
Yeah, you know, there's like a lot of denial too on the part of white people about like how they got to where they got, right? That like one of the ways that what's interesting about sort of white people is that they can't imagine that the government actually helped them out the way that they did. Like it becomes inconceivable. So when you think about solutions for black people, it becomes like hyper-local. It's like, well, we should have an after-school program. It's like, no, we should probably just like invest in public education in the way we invested in your schools, right? That like people, it's just hard for them to imagine that the government actually helped them out that much because like they are so invested in this idea of self-making, and that's just not true.
Well, and I've heard you talk about this on your show before, that there's a difference between, I didn't realize this, but it makes sense. There's the difference between the wealth gap and the wage gap. And there's a lot of conversations around the wage gap, but I feel like none of people are talking about the wealth gap and what that means.
Wages are about income, and income is like money you have today. Wealth is like money you can spend in the future. So the income gap is closing, the wage gap is growing, that white people benefit from having like generations of wealth that was either predicated on ill-gotten gains, like slavery, those sort of things, or was a result of government intervention. So what happens when you give people like a 1% interest loan for a house for 40 years is that like they can actually buy a house and afford it in a way that we just literally didn't do for anybody else. And their host is the racial wealth gap is like a much larger conversation, but it's projected by 2053, the median wealth for black people will be $0, which is the lowest it's been since the 20s. So there's a lot of work to be done there, and there's some incredible experts and activists sort of thinking about it.
Man, thank God that there are people out there thinking about that and doing the work and bringing it to our attention there. I don't want to take too much of your time, but I just wanted to... So, just a random thing. I just found out that your trademark vest has its own Twitter account.
Yeah, somebody made the Twitter account a long time ago, and somebody sort of runs it. I don't have access to it, but the vest is fun and funny. The account is funny. You know, I wear the vest.
You wore it to the Oscars. You were looking fly at the Oscars in it, if I can say. I was like, you better wear that vest. I loved it.
I didn't go to the Oscars, even though that's like often people keep saying that. I didn't go to the Oscars. I went to the Oscar. I went to like an Oscar viewing party and then the after party. But I was not at the Oscars. But I did wear, I wear it everywhere. So I wear it to the grocery store. So it's not like a people sort of obsession with this idea that like I just want to be seen. And, you know, it was cold so we were in the street for 400 days. It was the summer when it started. Then the winter came. And you know, it keeps me grounded in like how I got into the work, why I started, what it means to me. The Oscar dinner was good, and the Oscar after party was good, and so many good people who are committed to this work as well.
Sure, absolutely. And there seems to be a sort of new, I would say, Black arts renaissance that is happening right now. And, you know, the work that you're doing is absolutely influencing those artists. I love that I can turn on television and just watch Black excellence. Like, I can just watch so much beautiful melanin on my TV screen, or the movies that I go to, and, you know, the people behind the scenes. Like, I was fortunate to be at the Black Panther premiere and got to talk to all of the actors and Ryan Coogler and the people behind the scenes. Like, it seems like in the media sense, there's an awakening. Do you feel that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the protests definitely provided public space for a conversation about race that just didn't exist before. And I think that we've seen that play out for the past 4 years. It's like reaching, I think, its zenith right now, which is really dope to watch. So I'm hopeful that it'll lead to a real change. Like, you know, what you normally see in media representations of Black people is like Black people surviving trauma and then being really excited by the fact that they survived it. That's sort of like the theme. So it's always good when you see something that like breaks out of that formula.
Sure. Well, I just to wrap it up here, again, thank you so much for your time. You have an amazing podcast called Pod Save the People. Do it with three other co-hosts. I feel so much smarter when I listen to your show. I just feel like it's like this sort of like it's the news that I'm just not getting from other sources. So thank you so much for the amazing work that you're doing there with your show. And you're working on a book, correct?
I am. I should be writing the book at every single moment.
Amazing. When can we expect for that book to drop? Hit our shelves.
It's planned to come out in September, so it's called The Other Side of Freedom. You know, you can pre-order it now, but I'm still finishing the final parts.
Oh, awesome. Well, thank you so much for the work that you do. I want to leave you with the last word out to our corner kids who appreciate your time so much.
Yeah, remember, you know, that people built this, and because people built it, we can build something else. When people say, you know, the system is functioning exactly like it was designed, my takeaway from that is that it was designed. And because it was designed, we can design something better.
Beautiful. DeRay, thank you so much, my brother.
Cool. Talk to you later.
Bye. Oh, man. What a great interview with DeRay right there.
Oh, my God. Thanks for coming on the show, DeRay. That was awesome.
So great to have you there. What an action-packed episode. Just so much going on here.
Information.
Information land. Big shout out to our editor, Woody B.
Yes.
I don't know where I got the D from.
Thank you. Ooh,
it is towards the end of the show.
I know.
And a big thanks to Brownout for our music.
Thank you, Brownout. Thanks for not noticing yet either.
Well, they gave it to us.
Okay, they did.
They gave it to us.
That's true.
We got permission.
We did get permission.
And a Facebook message.
That's true. That's wrong. I shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Thank you for giving us permission, and we appreciate
it. There it is.
Yeah.
And you can get involved in the conversation.
Yeah, we're on Twitter, Minority Corner with a K. We're tweeting up a storm. Check it out.
Yes, absolutely. And you can also email us at minoritycorner@gmail.com.
Corner spelled with a K.
Show is. You better know. Look at your listening device and you'll see how it's spelled.
It's true.
Confused.
It's very true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you can send us an Ask Me Minority Corner anything, which we got one, but we'll save it for next week.
Yeah.
And ask us anything.
Yeah. Don't forget, join the Minority Corner Kids Playground on Facebook. Great community. People are enjoying it, talking to each other, sharing things.
And also, we're coming on the heels of the Max Fun Drive. I want to give a huge
thank you
to all of the new and upgraded members that are up in the fam.
Yeah, thank you, guys. And if you couldn't donate or become a member this time, thank you for listening. Your listening means so much to us anyways. Like, we couldn't be doing this without you guys listening and tuning in every week. It's awesome.
And especially if it's your first episode, hey, thanks for listening.
This one was fun.
Yeah. I bet you are like, oh my God, that was so much. I better get some more. And you can. We got 125 other episodes for you to enjoy.
Shit. That's a lot. You a lucky day, man. Goal
yeah,
mine.
Lucky you lucked out. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Thank you for listening to Minority Corner.
Because together, we're the majority.
Have a good week.
Bye.
Love you.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.